places. But it's a very, very characteristic machlokas about Bishamay and Bishul. It really shows you the two different strains of thought. And it's also very, very pragmatic in terms of the way we build yeshivos and communities of people, something you probably have thought about before. But here's really the mothership. This is really where the source of the whole debate stirs from. It's in the end of Perek Sheni, and it comments on the final part of that first Mishnah, the second Mishnah in Perkei Avos, where Shimon HaTzadik was Nishyari Kinesis HaGedolah, and they said three things. One of the first three statements of Perkei Avos, the first three statements of Chazal, and Nishyari Hen Mishunimadin, and Nishyari Latarav, and Nishyari Marbe. And although the first two seem like they're very deep and challenging, the third thing seems obvious. You have a lot of Talmidim. Like, what were they really Tzita? Like, come here, but evidently, you know, this is a time when Chazal weren't yet that popular as teachers, and people weren't that interested in, that they really had to train people to teach or to be students. This is obviously something that had to be said. I mean, it's a minim harbe. But yet, in Avos Triv Nosan, you don't forget, In Avos Triv Nosan, Beishama and Beishul actually debate what type of Talmud they meant, or what type of Talmud you should teach. And like I said before, it's characteristic of Beishama and Beishul in general. Look at Mishnah Tesh, Perek Beis. Hamidu Talmidim Harbe. So by Shabbai Omrim, Al Yishane Adam El Lamishu Chacham V'Anav Ben Avos V'Asya. These are the four criteria Shabbai imposed for teaching Torah. Person has to be rich. Person has to be wise. Person has to be humble. And it's that pedigree. V'Yishane Omrim L'Chol Adam Yishane Shaharbe Poshim Hayu Behem Yisrael V'Nishkarvu L'Talmud Torah. Now, when you see this Mishnah, and you certainly process it with modern sensibilities, so they still will see the scenes like the logical, the enlightened, the accepted one, and all of a sudden they somehow seems harsh and abrasive and exclusive. But when you think about it from a different perspective, Beishamah is representing a certain pure truth. Studying Torah is not like studying a book or a discipline or reading a math equation. You're studying Devar Elokim. It's an encounter with the reward of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which should be not just an intellectual encounter, but one of piety and one of deep reverence and deep meaning. And you shouldn't trivialize it. And if a person, let's say, is arrogant, then the Torah will just feel his arrogance. If a person doesn't have pedigree in Torah, it's not like we're going to blame him or castigate him or discriminate against him, but obviously someone with Torah pedigree, someone with a background in Torah, with parents who taught him Torah, parents who learned Torah, so understands Torah at a level that's so different, and that's just different intellectually, because sometimes when I meet the sons of Rabbanim, even if their Torah level is not necessarily greater than the person who doesn't come from that household, they just have stories, they know phrases. I remember there was I'm not going to say his name, but there was a person here whose father was a very, very well-known rabbinic personality a couple of years ago. And his father's not a Rosh Hashiva, but someone who has a lot to do with the Torah world. And he lived in a house in which Rosh Hashiva was always coming through, and people were always telling stories. It's just, you understand the breadth of Torah, not just the depth of Torah. You see Torah in its perspective. Someone who's not rich. So there's a great danger that we all face. You know, the Rambam felt, you're not allowed to pay kollel people. You're not allowed to make any money or any profit off of Torah. So our world has changed, and we can't support such a system anymore. But, you know, there's a great danger that someone that doesn't have financial independence will use Torah and exploit Torah just for financial gain. And, you know, that's why when people ask me, they want to become a mechanech, they want to be a Rebbe, should I get a backup? Should I go to college just in case? I say, you're getting a backup education, a backup profession is not necessary just as a backup based on a scenario that may or may not emerge that you'll fail at chinuch or get burnt out in rabbanus and you want to move over and become a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. But also because I want you to have that financial independence to know you can earn money so that you never have to be a mechanech that's co-opted. How many mechanechim have you met in your life that are stuck in institutions they don't identify with, but they need the parnasa and they have to toe the party line and say things they're not telling them, and almost all of you in many cases. You know, let's say Rav Aaron decided to turn this yeshiva into, I don't know, yeshiva committed criticism, something I felt uncomfortable with. I'd hang up my cleats and I'd go make $1 million, you know, or any other millions of ways. I don't do this because I need the money. It's my parnasa, but I can make a lot more money doing something else. And that gives me the freedom to say what I believe. And obviously, Baruch Hashem, I believe in what the yeshiva preaches. I'm able to present the institutional line, and also to think independently. And one of the problems when you're financially dependent on people is you start to think in timid ways that you want to find favor. Let's say, you know, I don't know if your father-in-law is supporting you. So, you know, basically you're sitting at the table, you don't argue. As much as you don't argue based on, you know, based on decorum and proper midos, you start to think, well, financial independence breeds intellectual independence. We start to think like other people. And if you can, so I don't think, you know, some people feel like, oh, you have to go to medical school and get an MD, PhD, and then you can go into Chinuch, so that if you ever burn out, you can enter the medical field the next day. I don't think you have to have that ability, but if you have a college education, you're someone who knows how to be diligent in your scholastics, you know, to take tests properly. So let's say you reach the point that you're 27 and you don't want to be a Rebbe anymore, you don't want to be a Mechanech anymore. Okay, so you'll go back to law school, you'll go back to medical school, you'll go back to business school, you'll take a loan out for a year or two, your parents will help you out, you don't have to be financially wealthy, you have to be financially potent, you have to have the potential to be an earner. And that's what I think college really gives you, not just a backup, but it just gives you persona, it gives you a voice that I think is really important as a Rebbe, not to be cowardly, not to be someone whose voice or position is co-opted. How many Haredi Rabbanim find themselves in modern Orthodox situations who have to say things they don't believe or adhere to policies they don't really believe in just because they need to put us? Or after the war, there were a lot of Orthodox Rabbanim from Europe who had to go teach or become Rabbanim at conservative schools, so those are the only schools they gave a part us. And ideally, you should be in a place that you really identify with the messages. So, Beis Shammai was really hitting on a very, very important point. You don't just teach Torah to whoever wants to. You don't just teach Torah to everyone. But if Torah's experience is to be pure and unadulterated, then the person has to bring to it certain characteristics, certain qualities. He has to be humble. He has to be a pedigree. He has to be wealthy. He has to be smart, not to distort Torah. And what you have all the time, and when you see it globally, you really see the difference between Shammai and Hillel, is that Shammai is the classic purist. He's always adopting the ideal, absolute truth, and he's staking it with harshness and with unconditional assertion. And Beis Hillel is always a pragmatist. So, for example, when Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argue, Kesa Meraktin Lefnei Hakala. So, in an ideal world, you should have one and only one value, and that's the truth. Midrash Eker Tirfak. And you shouldn't have any reason to lie, ever to tell a white lie. You should always adhere to the truth, because lying is very, very dangerous. It's the ultimate slippery slope. You first tell a white lie, and then another white lie, and then another white lie. And then you get very, very excited. Wow, I can really pull this off. I can say whatever I want to whomever I want and get away with murder, get away with, you know, manipulating people. I'll tell this one this thing, and that one that thing, and this one the third thing, and I'll be fast on my feet, and I'll keep a score of who I told what to. And then all of a sudden, you start losing sense of truth, and you become a dishonest person. And then the ultimate suffering is you lose the ability to know truth in yourself, and then you start to lie to yourself, because truth and falsehood just become exchangeable and interchangeable. So in the ideal world, you never really lie. In the ideal world, you tell the absolute, stark, and honest truth. And you go into this wedding in the ideal world, and if the kala's ugly, you say, by the way, you're an ugly woman. And she says, great, I'm so happy you think I'm ugly. That's why I'm not marrying you. That's why I'm marrying Spinkle over there, because he thinks I'm attractive. And it makes no problem. It doesn't feel insulted. And you have successfully been Mesamech the Kala and, you know, told the truth. And Basil says, well, wait a second. We're living in a real world. And in a real world, people have sensitivities and sensibilities, and they need other people to find them attractive. And this is her wedding day. So Beis Hillel compromises, concedes, Kalanava Chasidda, which is a violation of Midrash Eker Tirchak. So you can answer, it's Kavod Abriyos, you can answer, it's not really Seker, because Bidi's a fine Tirchim. But basically, the Machlokas Beis Shammai Beis Hillel is right along these lines of idealism, pure, unadulterated truth, the way the absolute value should be presented, and a pragmatic concession to the real world. And I'm thinking now, as I'm saying this, there's another machlokas, but this, my mind isn't catching. There's another well-known machlokas, Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, that falls along this fault line between absolute ideal truth and pragmatic concessions to. I can't remember it offhand. I'm trying to scour the, but that's one. What? You're possible like Basil, of course you're possible like Basil. Thank you. The gear, the grand job is thank this guy because he wants from Tara Galachas. And my son says, what are you kidding? What are you crazy? People spend millions of years or thousands of lifetimes trying to uncork the mysteries of Tara, and you want to recover it on 15 minutes, Tara Galachas? And he throws him out and he kicks him out. Basil knows that sometimes in Kiruv, we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, you have to use unorthodox methods. Sometimes you have to condense the truth. Sometimes you have to shade the message. You can't, here comes us, and once in the sky, so teach him every Kelsen Sach in the book. Now, it's not going to attract him to Yiddishkeit. You have to give him fast, quick appreciation of Yiddishkeit, and maybe, hopefully, his mind will be attracted, and he'll start to learn more and understand the deeper mysteries of the Avodas Hashem. So Meishol teaches him V'haftal Recha Kamocha, and ultimately the person becomes a Ger, a Ger Tzedek. This is a third classic machlokas, where Beis Shammai is taking the ideal position, an ideal world. But Beis Shammai says, in the real world, how many Talmidim will you have in your yeshiva? You have four Talmidim, five Talmidim that really meet these standards. So you have to relax the standards in order to spread Torah. And the point is, Jacob, as you said, that is precisely why we possibly like Beis Shammai. Because we live in a real world, and the heroism of living in a real world is not by ignoring reality, but by embracing it, making concessions, suffering those concessions, but trying to accommodate reality. But that's also why Jacob, Chazal said, that Asher Lava will possibly like Bishetma. Because Asher Lava will have a perfect world. In the perfect world, we can adhere only to truth, and we can teach only those who are of a certain pedigree, and we can, you know, tell every ger, you want to be a ger, open up above a comma, and I'll teach you how to be a ger. That's precisely why. And that's also why Chazal quote Beis Shammai, and this is really the rub. The danger of an idealist, of a purist, is that they become so detached from reality that their message no longer impacts reality, is for others doesn't have any relevance, and for themselves becomes bifurcated. You live one message in theory and one message in reality. It's not the weird real world we live in. And I'll talk about this a little bit later. The danger of a concessionist, of a pragmatist is, you become so pragmatic and practical that you forget what the ideal is. And today's concession becomes tomorrow's ideal. You forget the way things should be because of the way you're living life. And that's why the Gemara always quotes Beis Shammai, telling us, like, we're not going to posit like Beis Shammai, but this is really the world we should live in. This is the way we should operate. Ideally, Torah should be taught only to a certain select group, and ideally, truth should be adhered to, and ideally, Gerim should be substantive and content-driven, not quick-fix Gerim. And that's really more or less the divide between Haredim and non-Haredim in today's world. Basically, the Haredi approach is a Shammai approach. It's taking the ideal, impregnable truth and superimposing it on a fallen world. In the ideal world, a person learns Torah, Yom V'Lad. There's nothing else. No wars to fight, no states to build, no people to heal, no tikkun olam, nothing. You just learn Torah. That's what it was in Gan Eden for 12 hours. And in the ultimate ideal world, the Moshe Mashiach or Olam Haba, whatever you want to say, I don't want to get into the differences between the two, that's how the Rambam describes Olam Haba. Chacham Yosvim, that's a Sambar Hashem, and enemies of Hashem. They sit and only engage, whether it's Torah study or some other, but it's a purely spiritual. There's no chesed, no mitzvah. It's just purely you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu trying to, you know, understand and experience HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's mystical, intellectual, whatever that is. The question is, what about those 6,000-7,000 years of fallen reality in between? And the Haredi approach is a Shammai approach. We're going to superimpose the harsh ideal on an unaccompanied, no matter how incompatible it seems, no matter how asynchronous the world asks us to earn money, we're not going to, you know, in professions, the world asks us to improve. We are just going to recreate Gan Eden in a fallen world. What? I'm not saying this. I'm saying in theory, structurally, they're adhering to Shammai. We're adhering to Himmel. Basically, we're saying, you know what, that's the ideal, but we live in a fallen world. So if I were giving the Shir and Pagviz, the danger for a Shammai approach is, well, how many people really live that life, and who are you really affecting, and are you really changing the world? And at a certain point, the gap between ideal and reality is so large that it's unsustainable. At a certain point, I think the financial pyramid of the Haredi world is going to collapse. You can't be a couple of guys supporting 20 children, themselves with 20 children, and no one is earning a living. I mean, it's just going to collapse. But I'm not giving Shir and Pagviz. I'm not giving Shir here. This is the Bart. But, you know, here, the danger is how many of our people are willing to state to themselves, to others, yes, that is the ideal. I'm not going to say the word Haredi because that gets everyone all phobic. But that approach is the ideal approach. Ideally, I would love to be learning Yomam Balayla Shirti Bibes Hashem Kol Yimei Chayei. But look at the world that Kadosh Baruch Hu put me in. Look at the world I've fallen into. There needs to be people to heal others, to change the world, to redeem all the fancy words. I can go fancy just like the next guy. But to say, okay, I'm heroic in my ability to concede ideal to reality, that makes me heroic. But I'm not going to forget what the ideal is. And that is why the Gemara is always quoting Beshami, even though possibly Beis Hillel, it's important to recognize what the ideal is. And that's unfortunately in our community. It's just totally lost. The ideal is to come to Yeshiva for a year and then go off to college. That's the ideal. The ideal is to come to Yeshiva for 20 years. Okay, our society doesn't allow it. It's not the reality we live in. It's not. We have to make a just painful concession. But I would want every boy to walk out of this Yeshiva, whether you stay 1 year, 2 years, or 50 years, to feel a certain degree of pain or uneasiness when you leave Yeshiva. I'm now leaving the ideal, falling into a world that's not bad, that's heroic, that's pure, but it's not the ideal reality. And that's what people have such a hard time doing. They have a hard time living. So many people just accept their own mediocre reality as the ideal. And so many people dream of an alternate reality and their escapisms. And the real challenge in life is to live in two spheres, trying to make you guys a little apocalyptic. Not just to say, this is our world, and you want to live in Teaneck, you want to... That's fine. Make your decision. That's a legitimate decision. As long as you carry with you, I'm of another place. There's another place I belong in. Conditions don't allow me to be there now. Good conditions, noble conditions, legitimate conditions, valid conditions, heroic conditions. Say any words you want across the term learning versus working. Across the divide, to be able to say that, unfortunately, in our society, we've lost it. We have to try to return it. And unfortunately, I've said this message many times, and sometimes I've actually been called out. Fathers call me, like, Tarragon, you're trying to change your kids into a Haredi. No, it's not the message. It's not the issue. I'm trying to make sure that you're honest with yourself. Go and do Tikkun Olam, but there's no Tikkun Olam in Olam Haba, because it's already a perfect world. So just know what's eternal, what's transient. Just because it's transient doesn't make it less important. It may make it more important. According to our Sita, there's another Sita. That's really what you get to this in this machlokas b'sham b'sham. And this is really such a clear and direct moment where they're facing the ideal of Torah versus the reality of Torah. And it also provides two very different models of education. Right? In the real world, you could try to educate only the people that are, in terms that you guys use, the stark guys, and bring all the stark guys and collect them into the base of medicine. You know very well the yeshivos that you were part of or you were thinking about. Again, the shades are much more subtle. The issues are thinking about, by and large, structurally, you know, they're very similar. By and large, they're basically Beis Hillel. By and large. The whole modern Orthodox is from the high school, by and large. But in terms of shading, there's some yeshivas shade towards homogeneity and trying to create unity and peer pressure and one pure blend within the yeshiva. Again, very, very subtle in the yeshivas you were thinking about. And then the yeshivas would say, you know, we are going to try to reach out to people that don't have the experience of Torah. And you know, you guys aren't naive. You weren't born yesterday. You know, and you're experiencing the strengths and the weaknesses of each approach. Or at least in this case, you're experiencing firsthand the strength and weakness of our approach. The weakness is going to be an air that's not homogeneous. It's not going to be pure. People are going to be doing different things, dressing different ways, saying different things, thinking different things. And hopefully you're able to create at least a general collectiveness, a general container, so that it doesn't, and some places would accuse us of being too homogeneous. You know, why can't the guy come to us and do this and do that and do this and do that? And they say, because that is beyond our pale. And we're not interested in that. And we have certain things that are beyond our pale. And there's certain things even that guys here are doing now that are beyond our pale. And if we would have known that those, or if we had the choice, he may not have taken the boy in the beginning if he knew that thing. But once he's here already, say, well, once he walks through the doors of the base matters, now you have an even greater achrayus. Because discharging him, you're not just going to take away his chance to learn, but to alienate him. And so many people today, your parents' age, are alienated to Yiddishkeit, not your parents, but are alienated to Yiddishkeit because they just met the wrong rabbi at the wrong time. How many modern Orthodox people today just happen to meet the wrong rabbi at their wedding, in their high school? They just would have seen, you know whom, the rabbi that inspired you. I mean, their whole life would have been different. I get that all the time. Oh, finally met a rabbi, kind of, and just it's irredeemable. So he's hanging out at the yeshiva, and he does something, you know, it's not like he's doing something completely toxic to the society. It's just he isn't towing the line the way you'd want him to. If you're going to, so to speak, throw him out of yeshiva, so it's great, you can thump your chest and say, wow, we're the greatest yeshiva, we don't tolerate anything. Meanwhile, the guy is going to languish the next 70 years and not be from and turn other people off to some kind. You have to be a little courageous. above and whom you accept. And then some people say, you know what, I want to be a little less courageous, but I want to create for people that are in yeshiva an easy environment. And there's no right or wrong. And I want you to feel like I'm trying to skew the decision or tilt the scales in one. It's just built-in structural decisions. And you make one decision or another, and you can't reverse and you can't have both. And the question is, how close can you have to having both? So not just in the general sense, I have two different outlooks on life, but even educationally, you're getting two very different models. And the final part of the vart, the final part that I want you to see here, is a very interesting question having nothing to do with what I talked about right now. Beis Shmuel doesn't just say, teach people Torah because that's your moral mandate and it's Hashem's Torah. He says, I'll take a Rasha, and I'll create Kiruv through Torah. Shaharbe poshim hayu b'hem b'yisrael v'nishkarvu l'tal m'tara v'yatsamihem sadikim chasidim b'ksera. My point is as follows. Again, there's a great debate sometimes, and all I want to do is make sure you have balanced views. When you're in Kiruv, you're not in Gush Etzion. I don't mean Kiruv in Gush Etzion. You know, drive 100 miles south of Baltimore, you see what real Kiruv is. 100 miles, not 1,000. Drive 400 miles west of New York, you'll see what Kiruv is. People that have nothing, zero, zilch, real NCSY. I mean, Yentis Poincolo, real NCSY. So to what degree do you water down? Do you dilute? To what extent can you use tactics, Bible codes to catch people's attention? Really important questions. And the last person you want to ask about that is a Rebbe in Gush, because it's really not his right to say, because he's sitting there teaching Bava Kamma, and you have no clue about the challenges facing. So you can pontificate from today until tomorrow, but it's an important question. It's a very important question. For example, Chabad. Chabad, you know, gets a lot of bad press today, and some of it is deserved for the Aaron messianism. But I think some of the false bad press is, oh, this Kiruv, that Kiruv, this Kiruv, that Kiruv. And they do push the envelope, and basically what Chabad is saying is, I want you, basically, when you cut it down, they're saying, I want you to be Jewish. I don't care what that means to you. Just come, drive to the event Friday night, bring your whiskey, come to shul, don't come to shul, just be affiliated with the word Jew. And I think it's great, because I think that they're really on the front lines, and people are, and some people make it back, and some people don't make it back, but, and I'm not going to tell you stories, but I could tell you stories today or tomorrow about how much Torah and Frumkeit is being, people are miscarried to Chabad, and they never made it back, but they gave $30 million to the local Orthodox school, to local shul, and to the Kaila, I mean, they're not from, but there's a lot more Torah being learned because Chabad reached out to this guy on his own terms and got him into the fold, so to speak, rather than giving money to the PETA organization protecting animal rights or something. So I'm a big fan. On the other hand, to balance it out, sometimes we underappreciate the power of Torah and Kiruv. And Hillel's reminding us that there's something about meeting Devar Hashem, about encountering HaKadosh Baruch Hu on his own terms, not as a parallel to the New Year's Eve ball, or not because Matis Yo is going to give the rap concert, but, or not because the Maccabees will recreate. Simply, again, I'm not denouncing any of those, but there's something very, very powerful and restorative about connecting a person to Devar Hashem. I can't explain it to you, but that's what makes it Devar Hashem. And I could tell you an equal amount of stories about people who you'd think the road to Kiruv was razzmatazzing them with all sorts of tactics, and they just sat down and learned a Chumash and Rashi, a Mishnah, a Sefer, 13 letters, it changed their world. And you just have to know the time and the place for everything, and know the person you're speaking to. So if you're in a college setting or an NCSY setting, the person comes up and you feel they need Kiruv, they may need the embracing Kiruv at all costs. And I'm not going to give you the whole, and even Hillel himself was aware of that, based on the Gemara you quoted before in Shabbos Raman Aleph, where he had to water down Kol HaTarakula to get the Ger's attention and to pull on the moral strings of, well, Judaism is about ethics and morality. Basically, you look at Reform Jewry today, they're basically only prepared to hear that message. Most of Reform Jewry is a humanist religion. How can we find humanism in Judaism? How can we find morality and ethics and tree-hugging and just being nice to people, being common, courteous, etc.? And Hillel was dealing with the first Reform Jew. Turned out, he became an Orthodox Jew, so it wasn't Reform Jewry. Basically, Hillel was the first Reform rabbi. He didn't lead a Reform congregation, he gave the first Reform message. Just be a good person. Be nice to your neighbor. Pay your taxes on time. Everything else will fall into place. I'm just obviously coloring it for graphic detail. But then Hillel also comes back at you in the end of Avos Divnasan, and Perek Sheni says, sit down and learn Torah with them. Learn Shar HaMoed with them. Doesn't sound so moral. Learn Shar HaMishkel with them. Learn Dinei Zava with them. Just sit down and get them into HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world, and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu do Kira for you. Don't just be the Makariv, but let HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Gevar Hashem do the Kirav. And you have to find the time of life. No one can tell you. You'll meet these people. You'll see these people. But just giving them that experience, don't deprive them of it. Oh, that person doesn't know anything. Let me first talk to him about religion. To a degree, and going back to different yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael, that's also a divide. How much yeshivas talk about learning and talk about religion and talk about how much yeshivas just actually learn with you. And like I said, there's no one perfect recipe, and kids need different things. And in our wildest dreams, we couldn't recreate the type of success that some of our sister institutions have, a very, very different curriculum, more of the about curriculum, less of the substance curriculum. Types of successes they're having, it's simply incredible. And there's no way you took some of those kids and put them in our yeshiva, or a yeshiva like our yeshiva, they'd have even a fraction of the success. So it's just the question of appreciating the differences of people, the different needs that people have, and not, again, you get so passionate when you find your derech, which is wonderful that you bring that passion, it becomes almost impossible to believe there's another approach. And you always have to remain balanced and say, look, this is my MS. I found it. I love it. I can't imagine living without it. I'm going to deeply invest in it. I'm going to share it with others who want to hear it. But you know what? There are other forms of MS. There are other ways to approach it. And it's so hard at this age. Unfortunately, I don't see it being done often enough, because it's very easy just to pour some kerosene on your fire and get you to become, deeper, and it comes back to bite you. And you wake up one day and you realize, okay, this is your campfire, but there's another campfire down the line, and they're using different wood, and it doesn't make their campfire less. It just means you have your campfire, and you're happy you found it, and now, sit around the campfire and experience it. Okay, so these are three things that come out of this last Mishnah, Perek Bey's Mishnah test. Number one, the classic Shammai Hillel divide. Those are the three. You can see it in other Mechloksim, but those are the three primary Mechloksim. Keith and Meraktin, story with the Ger, and the story of the Sabbath Show. You can see it in other ones, but the other ones are much more halachic. These are the ones that are more existential. How do you treat a ger? How do you treat a kala? The second issue is, how do you build a yeshiva? Do you build Beis Shammai's yeshiva? Do you build Beis Shammai's yeshiva? Very simply put, the yeshiva Sevelt basically is aligned with Beis Shammai because of Rav Aaron Cutler and many of the other gedolim. After the war felt, we have to hunker down, insulate ourselves, Torah's under siege. We have to have a siege mentality. You can't go to college. You can't let anything in. And that's more or less the way the yeshiva world operates today. And the second you don't toe the line, you're out. I don't know what will happen in 50 years, but that's not the only approach. Surely not the approach that existed throughout the generations. It's the approach that I think worked very, very well in Chutz Laaretz in particular, in the post-Holocaust era. The Rav's modern orthodoxy saved Judaism, but wasn't able necessarily to create a rampant and broad-sweeping Torah Judaism, save Judaism, and I think led to the emergence of Torah Judaism. How many people today are Rav, Torah Madaniks, and you shouldn't learn and give your, let's face it. And it worked very well. Not what happened in 50 years, but, a train of a Tovlan that Rav Aaron Cutler and some of the other people had that vision to create Torah fortresses and to fortress everyone inside. And they saw a slightly different view. Slightly different structural view, I'm sure. Not everyone in front of you is a chacham asir, whatever, but it's that approach to create homogeneity and everyone being the same. And then there's Beis Shammai's approach, which is a little different. Okay, so that's your vart. Shabbat.